I'd like to take a moment to welcome everybody to this final study in the year 2011. Today's date is December 30th. Our study will be entitled Davidia's Kingdom Legacy. Purely and simply, our goal since the Lord met Jacob in that howling wilderness, the church's anticipated goal has been that of kingdom entry. We want to be a part of the kingdom of heaven. It cannot be put any more simply. If you like a basic answer to our orientation and our goal as a Christian, this is what we want. Unfortunately, we really do not know what that entails. Just as if you were a person that was born and raised in the United States, you have limited imagination even of what it's like to live in another country, maybe Peru, or even Canada. In some cases, even the next city in your own country. It takes education. I'm just glad that the Lord has supplied us with ample examples that we may be able to understand exactly what it takes on time or in the time when the kingdom is about ready to burgeon upon the world. We can know what it entails to garner membership therein. The Lord established a kingdom anciently with Israel. Obviously, then, it was a pattern after which we should expect from him today. You think about that. Why would the kingdom established for Israel by the same Lord that we worship today be different than the one that he wants to establish for us? Why would his kingdom then not reflect his kingdom now? Why would we not be able to extract from it lessons that are applicable to us today? This is what we call typology. Very few people in the Christian world seek out typology to understand what God's plans for them are. We've studied Jacob typology, and we've learned a great deal of lessons from it. In some cases, the two themes are intertwined. But kingdom typology has very special lessons for us that we will be able to extract today. And first and foremost, one of the simplest lessons that you must garner from kingdom theology and typology is that the kingdom has to have a king. It has to have a king. That's the way the Lord runs his kingdom. We know that by reflecting back in time. Some people would say, I don't believe that one man should be exalted to that station. Well, you haven't benefited from the lessons the Lord has left on record. He presided over Israel for 500 years without a king. And he lamented that that didn't work. And therefore, he installed a king. He first installed King Saul. And when that faltered and failed, he didn't say, be done with it. He found a king after his own heart, David, and he installed him. That's the undertones of the theme of our lesson today. We today consider ourselves Davidians, and that name is merely a reflection of the word David, showing that we look to David as being an illustration for the kingdom that we seek to garner entry into. Our purpose, though, is Mustard Seed Adventist, is to enlighten people. But we find that people have a difficult time making changes in their belief systems. That has always been the case. I point back to the marvel that occurred when Jacob was able to convince his two wives to make a major transition in their life. When you have to leave one location and go to the other based upon faith, we have to leave one system of theology, put that behind and advance forward, it becomes difficult. Therefore, the mustard seed advent has worked into our vocabulary a new theological term. Justification by nullification. What it simply means is that yesterday's doctrines no longer prevail upon you. Rachel, Leah, you've been living on Laban's ranch. He's your father. That's what you've known all your life. Today, we have to change. We have to leave. The unfaithful are unable to nullify yesterday's doctrines. And that's the difference between being carnal-minded and spiritually-minded. Think of some other example. Think of how difficult it was for Jesus to deliver a simple message that it's all right to heal folks on the Sabbath. To tell folks that he was the Son of God. That's why they crucified him on Calvary. It was difficult even to convince the disciples, that's applicable to us, isn't it, that they were to deliver his gospel to the Gentiles. Oh, that was a difficult message to him. They had to nullify their former stance and advance forward. The challenge was no less arduous and difficult when Christianity had to emerge out of Catholicism, when Adventists had to emerge out of Sunday keeping Christianity, when Davidians had to advance forward with the doctrines that they presented, and today the mustard seed presents a myriad of doctrines, more so than has ever been the case before. It requires nullification of everything that we've held dear in the past. It's called selling all that you have, preparing to deliver to the poor, and then purchasing the pearl of great price and following Christ. We mentioned the king of Israel. Saul faltered in his responsibility, but he was anointed by God. We try to kid ourselves, and some want to teach that he was the people's choice. No, the people agreed, they celebrated, but God, let it not be doubted, handpicked Saul. Just think the difficulty that the Davidian brethren would have back then if you were to deliver the message of justification by nullification and telling them that they had to leave Saul's kingdom and his authority in his house and transition under David's authority. That was a difficult message. David did not just drop out of the sky. Sometimes when God graces with light and truth, it takes a gradual progression. Often you can't perceive the changes. It's just like watching grass grow. My sons used to complain, we just cut the grass 2 weeks ago. But see, it grows gradually over time. Over time, I think it was a period of 9 years, Saul was combative with David. He sought to kill him and his troops. Finally, Saul's life ended, and David ascended to authority over not all of Israel, but only two tribes. When David emerged, he set up his kingdom where? I heard somebody say Jerusalem. That's what I wanted to hear, to give you an opportunity to practice justification by nullification. He set up his kingdom in Hebron. That prefigures our struggle with Saul today, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Our study will show that in 1930, Hebron represents the establishment of the Davidic kingdom under Vitiates' leadership of the Shepherd's Rod movement. We can begin by turning to 2 Samuel, chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Then we're going to read verse 11, then chapter 3, verse 2. And it came to pass after this, that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said unto him, go up. And David said, whither shall I go up? And he said, unto Hebron. So David went up thither, and his two wives also, verse 3. And his men that were with him did David bring up, every man with his household, and they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. Notice here. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Pausing for a second, I want you to see that David's move to Hebron was inspired by the Lord. Thus, to leave Hebron, you're automatically going to have resistance because you'll be able to say, well, the Lord told David to establish himself here. You've got to learn how to nullify yesterday's advances to receive the manna that the Lord has today. But you also need to know that in Hebron, David went up with his troops, but he was not anointed king. And when he was anointed king, he was only anointed king over one house, over Judah. Verse 11. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, verse 2. And unto David were sons born in Hebron, and his firstborn was Amnon. We're going to pause there. David's excursion in Hebron was not such that he ruled over all 12 tribes. He only ruled over one tribe. The other tribe, surprisingly, was continued to be governed under the house of Saul. You had a period of time where David ruled Judah and his troops, his disciples, and the house of Saul ruled the rest of Israel. That's why it's such a beautiful parallel to our Seventh-day Adventist experience. In Hebron, Davidia did not rule the whole house of Israel. Davidia is only going to rule the whole house of Israel when they go to Jerusalem. I told you, if you want to know kingdom typology examine the Lord's kingdom that he established. David's seat in Hebron does not depict his eternal kingdom. His seat in Jerusalem depicts his eternal governance. It yielded the ones who inherited the throne. I made sure that that term ones is plural, because the inheritance of the throne of David in the temporal kingdom was governed by two of his sons. We're in the book of Samuel. Let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Somebody is thinking to themselves, every time we have a study, it seems, you go to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Well, understand, the promise that was given to us by inspiration, new meaning flashes forth from familiar text. And consequently, when you examine the text from a different perspective, you're going to seek to extrapolate new meaning. The new light that we're going to see may seem subtle, but every light that begins to emerge does so in the same way. Think of the blade of grass again. Think of the sunrise. You don't go from pitch dark midnight to noonday brightness. It's a slow transition. Let me take you to 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 10. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel. That has already new and deeper insight and meaning, doesn't it? Continuing with the verse. And will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more. I like that, because we started our study talking about moving. You're going to be settled, the verse tells us. Continuing with verse 10. Neither shall the children of the wicked afflict them anymore as before time. We've shown in the past that such a situation has never prevailed. Obviously, when they're in this settled place, it's not in heaven, because in heaven, the children of the wicked would not have opportunity to afflict them. This is referring to the place that the Lord is going to establish them in the last day, in our day, before the second coming of Jesus, before the time where we're taken up to heaven. This was the kingdom image that Viti Hotep gave us. Now we have greater clarity, and we can examine these references and extrapolate from them even deeper meaning. Let's read verse 11. And as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee an house. To have a house, you've got to put that on real estate, don't you? 2 Samuel chapter 7, we've read verse 11. Let's read verse 12. And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy father, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And I will be his father, and he shall be my son. And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee, and thy throne shall be established forever. What the Lord was communicating to David was that he was going to go to the grave and sleep. But his seed would emerge in the day when the Lord was going to settle Israel into this one house, in this one location, and they would dwell there forever under the authority of David's future son. And it says, you're going to witness it because it's going to be established before thee, indicating the doctrine of resurrection, not fully described here, but shown in other places. David is going to be in the kingdom, and he's going to witness the fruition of this promise. This is the promise of the Lord's kingdom. This is Christ, we've shown from studies, in a way that is incontrovertible. It was Christ who communicated these promises to David. And it was Christ who, under the impress of the highest, the Father, delivered the testimony. We refer to the testimony of Jesus, so that we can learn more about the kingdom. And in that testimony, he told us that all these prophecies are going to be fulfilled. In fact, he commanded us to never think that they will not be fulfilled. We need to know from that all kingdom prophecies that pertain, given to us in the testimony of Jesus, in the gospel, are applicable to this promise that was made to David. So certain are they that David was promised that he would witness them in his day. What type of Lord do you think that you serve who would lay David to rest and abrogate that promise? Such a Lord could not convey to you a promise that you could trust. Hence, we need to settle on this gospel of the kingdom. We need to look forward to this ever lasting throne, the one that shall never be done away with. That fits neatly into our study in Revelation chapter 14, verse 6. You've heard of the three angels' message, haven't you? The three angels' message affirms this concept of the everlasting. It doesn't call it the everlasting kingdom. It has a different name for it. It says, "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel." It's not just the gospel. It's the gospel of the everlasting light and truth. The Lord, during His testimony, gave to us that gospel. It was the gospel that you will have life that will last forever. The people who fulfill this promise, when the first angel's message that we're reading about here is reiterated, will teach the truth about your everlasting life in the everlasting kingdom. That's the everlasting gospel. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, to preach unto them that dwell on the earth. Speaking of the king that's going to reign, it's also encompassed within Revelation chapter 14. It is described as the messenger on the cloud. That's Revelation chapter 14, verse 12. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. What was the faith of Jesus? The faith of Jesus was the word that He delivered us. We know of very little else that Jesus said other than the faith that Christ articulated through Him at the Father's behest. The patient saints, those who patiently forbear, are going to keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. One of those commandments is, "Think not that I come to destroy the law or the prophet," referring to the prophecy. "I come not to destroy, but to fulfill." We can rest assured then that the kingdom typology that gave us kingdom prophecy is going to be kingdom reality. All you need is patience, and you're going to have a king. Just as you may have had difficulty transitioning from Saul's administration to David's administration, evidently they did, because not all of the other tribes anointed David. Just are you going to have to make a transition from the Seventh-day Adventist leadership and from the Davidic leadership as manifested through Hebron to the eternal leadership that's established in Jerusalem. That's why now I take you to the same context, Revelation chapter 14, and read verse 14. "And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle." This is David's eternal son. The sickle symbolizes his conduct of the harvest. He's seated on the cloud, which means that he's been elevated above the earth. We can connect that with Jacob typology, can't we? Because in Jacob, he's commissioned in Isaiah 58 to blow the trumpet in his house, in the house of Jacob. And from that trumpet, the faithful will heed his call and be able to ride on the high places of the earth. They're going to be seated on the cloud. And so John looked, according to verse 14, and beheld a white cloud, and upon the cloud sat one like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown. If he's like unto the Son of Man, that means that he's like unto Christ. He's like unto the Son of Man because he's a man after the Lord's own heart. Verse 15, "And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in the sickle and reap." This is the sickle thrusting commissioner. This is Christ. The Bible describes him as an angel. That shouldn't surprise us that we see that in Revelation, because in Genesis, he was described by Jacob as the angel of God as well. Jacob communicated to his wife that he spoke with the angel of God. He was in communication with Christ. The promises that were conveyed to Jacob then, "I will be with you and I will bless you," are manifested at the end of the book. They're manifested in this verse that we just read. He's going to gather all nations. We can learn a lot, can't we, from examining the kingdom as it existed and from studying the pronouncements and the prophecies of the king that pertain to it. Psalms chapter 110. "The Lord," verse 1, "the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool." So this person obviously is going to have all of his enemies beneath him. another metaphor that can likewise be symbolized by the fact that he's going to be seated on the cloud. Sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send a rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. How can you rule in the midst of your enemies with a rod? You can only do so if you've been empowered over them, seated on the cloud. I like what it says here. It comes out of Zion, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It's the rod of strength that comes out of Zion. Not the rod of 1930, the rod of Hebron, but the rod that's got power. It's the second phase Davidic movement that emerges. Let's speak a little bit more to that, but first let's turn to see what the Lord's comments on that text were. Matthew chapter 22, verse 41, it says, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them. I want to point out the end result of this question eternally silenced the Pharisees. They could not answer it. History shows that they were the best Bible scholars in the world. Consequently, your Pharisees today can't answer this question either. What think ye of Christ? Whose son is he? That's very important because it shows you that the person whom the Lord referred to, his name is Christ. And this Lord has a father. Else Christ would not have asked the Pharisees, whose son is he? And they said unto him, the son of David. And he said unto them, how then doth David in spirit call him Lord, saying, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand, till I make thine enemies thy footstool. If David then called him Lord, how is he his son? And no man was able to answer him a word, neither durst any man from that day forth ask him any more questions. Remarkably, this is why we did a four-part series as a section of our study of authentication on the Psalm of David, because you cannot advance in the Davidic kingdom unless you understand the promises, the prophecies, and the pronouncements that David made pertaining to the Lord. And when he referred to the Lord, he was referring to Christ. The best scholars in church history could not assail that doctrine. They were speechless. It gives us new insight and new meaning and understanding and really greater affirmation about the applications of the temporal kingdom established under David to our anticipation of the kingdom today. We've done a lot of study on this, and I should add before I leave Matthew 22 that Christ quotes Psalms 110, and he attributes those words to David. He said, David said in spirit. He was inspired by the Holy Spirit. How then doth David in spirit call him Lord, saying, the Lord said unto my Lord. There's a conversation that's taking place, not by David's own imagining, but by the prompting of the Comforter, whereby Christ was speaking to somebody else, whom David called his Lord. The only person that could be is expressed in 2 Samuel chapter 7 that we read, and elsewhere, the eternal Son of David, the one to whom the Lord promised would inherit the kingdom forever. If he inherits the kingdom, and David witnesses it, then David's place in the kingdom is that of servitude to a son. That's why he says, David said in spirit, the Lord said unto my Lord. We know that the Lord who's communicating is Christ. The Lord whom he's speaking to is not Jesus, because this Lord is commanded to sit on Christ's right hand. Jesus ascended and sat on the Father's right hand. This Lord, according to Psalms 110, leaves Zion with the rod and rules amidst his enemies. Jesus rules with his Father the entire universe. That grace is not given to David's Lord, except by virtue of the fact that Jesus ruling the universe and planet Earth being a part of the universe would also fall under his administration. But let it not be misconstrued that the conversation that Christ had with David's Lord pertained to David's son, the one for whom he promised to build a house and to establish his kingdom forever. We know that it has to be because he is commissioned to sit on his right hand until he makes his enemies his footstool, till he gets a mastery over the planet Earth. Why the mustard seed is not out there trying to win an election, trying to garner any other type of power. It sits in peace and teaches at the Lord's right hand. And then when the Lord unveils him to the earth, he will be able to respond to the commission to thrust in the sickle. There'll be no governments or no religious authorities that will be able to resist Father's efforts to win for him as many on the earth that can be harvested. Unequivocally then, we understand that the Lord's pronouncements about the kingdom, and there are many, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a merchant man who sought after a pearl of great price. The kingdom of heaven was as 10 virgins, 5 wise and 5 fools. All of these are illustrative of an exemplary pointing to the kingdom that was going to be established, which is patterned after the temporal kingdom that was given to Israel. Another kingdom that was promised by the Lord, the mustard seed kingdom. The kingdom of heaven is as a grain of mustard seed, which is the least of all seeds. There was an interruption, though, in David's house. And today we have to give an accounting for the interruption of his reign. David supplanted Saul, and he took away the kingdom from Saul's house. This victory garnered for him not just eternal reign personally, but eternal reign through his lineage. Right after King David came Solomon, his son, then his son Rehoboam, then came Abijah, then Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, Joash, Amaziah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, all these generations down, Ammon, Josiah, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and then Zedekiah. And with Jehoiakim and Zedekiah, they were taken into Babylonian captivity. You studied about that, haven't you? Funny, the Bible makes a lot of lessons out of Babylon, and we as Adventists have joyed in those lessons. Why haven't we joyed in the typology that we're able to win from understanding and studying the Davidic kingdom? The house of David was banished from the seed that descended through Solomon. You all understood that and knew that, right? Now understand, it was taken from King Saul and given to David, and it was promised to be part of David's sons. It wasn't promised to be part of Solomon's sons. A transition took place. The children of Judah, children of 10 tribes of Israel, long time scattered, the children of Judah inherited their rebellion and their wickedness. And the Lord sent a message of justification by nullification through the prophet Jeremiah. Yesterday, you were promised that Jerusalem and Palestine would be yours forever. But today, you have to surrender to the king of Babylon and go into Babylonian captivity. This is punishment for your wickedness. There's got to be some price to pay for sin. You swore a covenant that you would abide. And now I have this remedy. I can save you, but I've got to punish you. I can't show to the universe my austere punishment and my severe wrath against the heathens that occupied Canaan. And you come in and you commit sins equal to theirs and worse, and yet you go unscathed and unpunished. King Jehoiakim couldn't take it. He was part of that troop, that Davidian troop. This says, no, this was promised to us yesterday. It's going to last forever then. We don't believe in nullification. And Jeremiah wrote a scroll. You see how I do my writing. It comes easy. You write on a scroll, it takes a lot of time. But he was in jail, so he had a lot of time to do it. The king didn't like his message, so he threw him in jail. Determined to heed the Lord's commission, he wrote the scroll by the hand of his servant, and he had him read it in the temple. And what do you suspect that King Jehoiakim's reaction was? What he did, he took the scroll. It was in the wintertime. He was sitting there in his winter house by the fire. He took it and threw it in the fire. Not willing to be deterred, Jeremiah from his prison house wrote another scroll. And he gave a pronouncement. And we want to read that pronouncement. We can learn lessons from merely studying the typology of the kingdom as it existed yesterday. I said Jeremiah chapter 36. I want you to refer now to verses 29 through 31. And thou shalt say to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, this is his punishment. Thus saith the Lord, thou hast burned this roll, saying, why hast thou written therein, saying, the king of Babylon shall certainly come and destroy this land, and shall cause to cease from thence man and beast. Therefore thus saith the Lord of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, he shall have none to sit upon the throne of David, and his dead body shall be cast out in the day to the heat, and in the night to the frost. That was his punishment. I used to read this and think, well, he's getting off light. Because the Lord would, in times past, issue punishments much more severe. But understand, the Lord is a God of governance. The covenant was that you had to obey the commission that was articulated to you from Sinai. And that if you did that, then you'd be preserved. The king's responsibility was to respond to the prophecy. He stubbornly refused. He wasn't in violation of the covenant. He was just refusing to hear the voice of the Lord. If you refuse to hear the voice of the Lord, then you cannot be considered a man after the Lord's own heart. You cannot receive salvation. But truth be told, his body would be cast out into the heat. What difference did it make knowing the state of the dead to Jehoiakim? He wouldn't know one way or the other. He couldn't celebrate. The reality of his punishment will come forward in the resurrection when the sons of David gather together under David's Lord as the eternal king. And they will celebrate the fact that their lineage seats on the throne, whereby the rebellious will not be seated. Actually, the rebellion started with Solomon, and the lineage of the kings extended all the way through him to Jehoiakim. That whole branch of David's lineage will not have their posterity vested in the mustard seed. And that's what this penalty is for. So Jehoiakim, well, I can deal with that. But when he comes forward in the resurrection, and the Lord saves the whole house of Israel, then he's not going to have the joy that he could have had. Consequently, if it doesn't come through Solomon, whose lineage does the kingdom come through? Let's turn to Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 4, verse 7 through 10. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain, and he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shouting, crying, grace, grace unto it. Zerubbabel brings to you the grace. He brings the sure mercies of David. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. For who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. Okay, well, we see that Zerubbabel is going to be the one that's going to orchestrate the gospel. His signet, his antitypical seed, is going to be the enthroned king sitting on the cloud. It's going to thrust forth the sickle. He's going to have grace for the world. I'd like to take a moment to read the reference E.G. White as well, one that you're all familiar with, volume 8, page 322. In his light shall we see light, until mind and heart and soul are transformed into the image of his holiness. Wonderful possibilities are open to those who lay hold of the divine assurances of God's Word. There are precious truths to come before the people of God. Privileges and duties which they do not even suspect to be in the Bible will be laid open before them. As they follow on in the path of humble obedience, doing His will, they will know more and more of the oracles of God. Let's read a little bit more about Zerubbabel. Haggai, chapter 2, verse 21 through 23. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen. Wow, Lord's going to do that. Tell this to Zerubbabel. In that day saith the Lord of hosts, so not today, but there's going to be a day. It evidently has to be a day yet future, because this has never happened. Continue to read. In that day saith the Lord of hosts, I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel. Gives you his lineage. That's important to remember as we proceed. I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee. Zerubbabel is the signet. This promise that he's going to be the one that's going to orchestrate grace, he's going to be the one that's going to preside over the heathen, merely manifests that his lineage is going to receive the mantle and the banner. How could that be? Well, Zerubbabel is a son of David through a different line. Who was Zerubbabel? He came after the dispersion. He came after the fall of the first house. The children of Judah were taken captive under Babylonian yoke. And Babylon fell. They fell under the Medo-Persian yoke. And then they were sent back to rebuild Jerusalem. And Zerubbabel orchestrated that rebuilding campaign. That's why it says, his hands have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands shall also finish it. It was the house that Zerubbabel erected that the Lord came and gave his testimony. And that happened some 500 years later. We're anticipating the finishing of that house the rearticulation of the testimony by the last day servant that the Lord promised to convert, the one who's going to descend through the Zerubbabel's lineage. He was not king, he was a governor. Why was he a governor? Because they were under the protectorate of the Persian governance that ruled the world. Since that day, Judah had no king, because after the Medes and Persians fell, the Greek authorities rose to world preeminence, and Judah had to pay tribute to them. Then the Romans, then they were scattered, and they haven't been reestablished since. We look forward to, therefore, the day when we'll have redress and relief from heathen tyranny and oppression, just as the Lord promised David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Well, they will have peace from the heathen. To understand a little bit more of the genealogy, we have to read about the lineage through David. And I find that in Luke chapter 3, beginning with Jesus, verse 23. And Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph. The lineage you're going to read here is Joseph's lineage. Verse 27. We saw that Joseph, which was the son of Heli. Then it takes you back all the way to David. Verse 27. Which was the son of Joanna, which was the son of Risa, which was the son of Zerubbabel. It's spelled a little bit differently there, isn't it? Which was the son of Shealtiel, which is the same as Shealtiel, which was the son of Neri, verse 31, which was the son of Mahli. Hopefully you understand, you're not getting tied up in the genealogy here. It's showing you the male lineage as it progresses back to David, which was the son of Mena, which was the son of Matatha, which was the son of Nathan, which was the son of David. The lineage comes not through Solomon, but through Nathan. This is why the complexities of the Davidic kingdom require our studious effort. Solomon's line was disinherited from the throne. In fact, if you read the pronouncement in, I believe it's 2 Kings, the Lord told Jeroboam that he was going to take away 10 tribes from Solomon. And he left him with the tribes of Judah and Benjamin for his sons to rule. And that's how you had the split kingdom. And then, finally, when it came to Zerubbabel, the lineage was transferred over. But there was no throne to be seated until our day, when the prophecy that was made to Zerubbabel pertained to the last day kingdom that the Lord would erect, given him power and authority over the Gentiles or the heathen. This would be conveyed through his son, the son of David. It doesn't disqualify the promise that was made to David that his son would emerge after him. It didn't say through whom. Let us now take the study into a slightly different direction. Let's read 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1 through 5. Now these were the sons of David, which were born unto him in Hebron. The Bible gives you an account, not only of his sons, but it tells you where they were born. When was David born in Hebron? The Lord told him to go to Hebron. The firstborn, Amnon. Amnon was the firstborn son. The second, Daniel. The third, Absalom. Verse 4, I'm skipping down. These six were born unto him in Hebron. And there he reigned 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years. Verse 5. And these were born unto him in Jerusalem, Shimei, and Shobab, and Nathan, and Solomon, four of Bathsheba, the daughter of Amiel. Who was Bathsheba? Bathsheba. Bathsheba was Solomon's mother. Isn't that right? Well, it tells you here, David had many other sons, but let us first drink down, without discussing further, that two of the sons were the ones that orchestrated the kingdom. In fact, Solomon orchestrated and reigned over the temporal kingdom, and Nathan is the one that's going to reign over the eternal kingdom through the line of Shealtiel and Zerubbabel, and perhaps through the line of Joseph. That is the lineage that's going to rule the eternal kingdom. Those sons were not born under the old administration, under the first phase of the Davidic kingdom. Remember, we discern that Hebron represented our work for the church in the Viti Hatav era. In the Viti Hatav era, we learn of the Davidic kingdom, hence we were called Davidians. But a transition is going to take place, a nullification is going to take place, and the authority that we thought was vested in Solomon's house is going to be vested in Zerubbabel's house. David's first son therefore would have to represent, using typology, the vestiges of the early Rod movement, the ones that will be disinherited from the throne. Their concept of the kingdom will be nullified, just as Solomon's authority was nullified. And a new concept will be installed. And who was David's first son? Amnon, the rapist. Amnon fell in love with David's daughter to another wife. And he cooked up a scheme to garner power over her. And he went in, and she, being dutiful, thinking to minister unto him and to serve him, began to prepare a meal for him. She was innocent in the entire escapade. Amnon chased away all the men out of the house, men being representative of leadership. This is why Davidia jealously guards anybody who tries to teach alternate religion. They're chasing the men out of the house. Their desire is not to elevate the house or the kingdom. Their desire is self-gratification. They're quintessential politicians. And those people who subscribe to their authority and their leadership are going to find themselves at a loss for their purity. Their garments are going to be stripped off of them, and they're going to weep and gnash their teeth. In fact, poor Tamar, she gave a prophecy of that very thing. 2 Samuel chapter 13, verse 11 through 13. And when she had brought them unto him to eat, he took hold of her and said unto her, Come lie with me, my sister. And she answered him, Nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly. And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee. Amnon didn't want to talk to the king. But Tamar said, speak unto the king. Go down to verse 18. And she had a garment of divers colors upon her. For with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins apparel. Then his servant brought her out and bolted the door after her, locked her away. She petitioned Amnon not to proceed. And her warning was, you'll become one of the fools in Israel. I don't recall reading anything about a class of people termed as the fools in Israel. I've heard the military garrisons of Israel. I've heard the royal arm of Israel. But Tamar enlightens you to a new classification, fools in Israel. The only resolution that we can uncover to discern that is what the Lord told us about his kingdom. The kingdom of heaven will be as 10 virgins, 5 wise and 5 foolish. He that heareth these sayings of mine and believeth them not, him shall I liken unto a fool, fools in Israel. That's the first installation of David's authority, the first arm of the Davidic kingdom. Therefore, it's no coincidence that when we read Ezekiel chapter 8, we could read the entire chapter, time will not allow. Now, Ezekiel, called the Son of Man, he's shown all the sins of the house of Judah. He gets deeper and deeper, and he shows their abominations. And who would dare assert that by Davidia exalting Vitihotep's work and E.G. White's work above Christ would not rank as the basis of abominations? How dare any think that you could do that and not be classed in this description? And we see that as we read verse 14. And he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Tammuz being prefigurative of Tamar. Women who have been deceived and eternally lose their purity and eternally lose out because they gave obeisance to Amnon, David's first son, and because they fell victim to his sophistry. These are women that will weep bitter tears. These represent Davidians that have ignorantly and naively marched forward in the path under the Hebronic installation of Davidia and have refused to advance. They refused the doctrine of nullification. The first son of David can't take you to the kingdom. Only the son born in Jerusalem can. Jerusalem is the bastion that's going to be established forever. Therefore, Ezekiel chapter 9 shows that they will be cut down in the slaughter. We've seen evidence of this from prophecy, namely Ezekiel 33. It shows you that the Lord anointed Ezekiel to blast a trumpet to the watchmen. The watchmen would be the men, the people in authority. And he said, if they fail to heed the warning, They can't save the people in the city. The people in the city will fall by the sword, but the watchmen will be made accountable for their death. We have a prophecy that validates the thesis behind women weeping for Tammuz. It's a sad day because Davidia has turned its back on the Lord and has refused to advance in his kingdom. They've thrown the scroll, as it were, in the fire. They've destroyed his warning messages. And now, being misled and being too trusting of false leadership, they suffer the penalty. True indeed, David gained victory over the house of Saul. But they didn't have justification there. They had to advance. The Lord commissioned them to establish their kingdom and bring their garrisons to Hebron. And that's where the house of Judah anointed. The house of Judah being the more fastidious house, being the ones more careful to the law, being the house that was preserved, that received the Lord at his first advent, represents the people that are more fastidious. It represents the Davidian arm of the Adventist church. But the throne that the Lord promised to establish forever was not the throne as established in Hebron. Let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 4. Nevertheless, for David's sake, did the Lord his God give him a lamp in Jerusalem. I like that expression. He gives him a lamp. That means David's inheritance is to enlighten. This is what we saw with Zerubbabel. This is why he had the seven candlesticks. This is why he's the purveyor of grace. He's the extension of David's lamp, to set up his son after him and to establish Jerusalem. The Lord's burden was not to establish Hebron, but to establish Jerusalem. But how long? Let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 35. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand, and I will give it unto thee, even 10 tribes. This is the promise that was given to Jeroboam because Solomon sinned and fell out of grace. We see here the fulfillment of this study even more so because he promised to take 10 tribes out of them, all the way down to Jehoiakim. Remember the king who threw the scroll into the fire? He took the other 2 tribes from his lineage. And unto his sons, verse 36, will I give 1 tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen me to put my name there. When you proclaim the name of the Lord, you're showing a Davidic manifestation of the Jerusalem light, not the Hebronic light. This is the light that the Lord promised to establish forever. He wanted his name to emerge out of Jerusalem. This is why the first wave of Davidic brethren, the Ebionites, they don't teach the name of the Lord. They teach Constantinian Christology. They teach that Jesus Christ and Father are 3 segments of 1 personality, referred to as the triunity. For David's sake did the Lord give him a lamp in Jerusalem to set up his sons after him and to establish Jerusalem. From Jerusalem, the name of the Lord will be declared. We have a merging, therefore, of the prophecies and of the types. Moses was the one who promised to declare the name, and we have seen from prior studies that that prophecy has not come to fruition until now. Moses' prophecy is really a depiction of the son of David, of the son of Zerubbabel, who will declare the Lord's name and spread glory throughout the earth. He will be the one who thrust in the sickle to reap the earth. As we bring this study to a close, we saw the battle with Saul. It represents the dispute between Davidia and the Seventh-day Adventist church, where Davidia was finally able to separate itself and establish its own bastion of light, independent of the Adventist ministry. That prefigures David establishing his seat of authority at Hebron. Inspiration through Davidia, though, comes in 2 stages. Hebron, the temple, and Jerusalem points to the everlasting kingdom. Solomon's banishment and Nathan's honor, both born in Jerusalem, expressly manifest justification by nullification. We presume Solomon's throne to be perpetual, only to uncover that the Lord had a different design. The Lord had a second stage to the fulfillment of his prophecy. The sons of David, through Nathan, were never enthroned as king. That day is only going to prevail today, in the last day. This is our Davidian legacy.
Christ's Object Lesson, page 132. God's holy and educating spirit is in his word. A light, a new and precious light, shines forth from every page. Truth is there revealed, and words and sentences are made bright and appropriate for the occasion as the voice of God speaking to the soul. The words of truth will grow in importance and assume a breadth and fullness of meaning of which we have never dreamed. The beauty and riches of the word have a transforming influence on the mind and character. The light of heavenly love fall upon the heart as an inspiration.
And with that, I bring the study to a close.